Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
Frankly, if Hillary Clinton were a man, I don't think she'd get 5% of the vote. The only thing she's got going is the woman's card.
We're going to imagine a tomorrow where hard work is honored, families are supported, streets are safe and communities are strong, and where love trumps hate.
That basketball ring here in Indiana, it's the same height as it is in New York City and every other place in this country. And there is nothing that Hoosiers cannot do.
What we are seeing on national polls, which have us 15, 20 points ahead of Donald Trump, far more than Secretary Clinton.
This is The Takeaway. All aboard. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Five states voted in yesterday's round of primary elections. All of them are Northeast Corridor stops on the Amtrak rails. By the end of the voting, it was a Trump express, though, stretching from Maryland, Delaware, through Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. The Hillary Clinton train stopped at the Connecticut border. Senator Bernie Sanders won Rhode Island. Hillary won the rest. But Hillary Clinton now has 90% of the delegates needed for the Democratic nomination. On the GOP side, it's only a little less complicated. 39 states have voted now, including the District of Columbia. Donald Trump has won 26. Ted Cruz has carried 10. Alaska, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Maine, Oklahoma, Texas, Utah, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. Don't try to take this down and just drive off the road. It's a radio map, okay? Marco Rubio, remember him? He snared D.C. and Minnesota. That's all. And Ohio Governor John Kasich is holding on to his beloved Ohio. That's all for him. For a closer look at what the numbers mean at this point in the campaign, we turn to Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent for Politico. Anne, great to talk to you.
Great to be here.
So presumptive nominee, Donald Trump at one point used that phrase to describe himself. Is that a mathematically precise term, presumptive nominee?
Yeah, I think after last night, we can really say that Trump will get to that magic number of 1237 on the first ballot at the Republican convention in Cleveland this summer. I mean, he basically blew away the competition. He won all of those five states with 29 points or more, which is just like it's unbelievable, really.
And what happened? There was going to be a contested convention, it looked like, just 3 weeks ago, but that's gone for sure, or could it come back?
I mean, it's not necessarily gone for sure. I mean, you don't have John Kasich or Ted Cruz saying they're going to drop out of the race, right? The last stand for Ted Cruz is Indiana. But the momentum really is in Donald Trump's favor. If it was any other candidate except for Donald Trump, the entire party would be going behind that candidate and would say that he is the presumptive nominee.
So the presumptive scenario for both parties is let's get this over with quickly. And it's only the fact that Donald Trump is such an unusual outlier that gives the Republicans pause. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, he has really rubbed the establishment Republicans the wrong way throughout this entire race. And so hasn't worked to try to get them on board. But if it was any other candidate, they would be lining up behind him. They would be starting to really work on that general election scenario. There would be a lot more pressure on Ted Cruz and John Kasich to bow out of this race. But for all argument's sake, I mean, Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee at this point.
I don't want to sound like, you know, some naive, I don't know, wuss or something, but what is it about Donald Trump? He can say stuff that nobody else can say. You heard his remark last night about Hillary Clinton playing the women card, and if she was a man, she could only get 5%, and the beauty is that women don't even like her.
I think what we saw last night, Donald Trump
about?
Is Teflon, right? He's political Teflon. If any other candidate said half of the things that he's said for the past several months, they would be forced to have a press conference, apologize, and then probably drop out. I think what we saw last night was a preview into what he does. He's trying to start this general election scenario, and he really gets these narratives going, whether it was low energy for Jeb Bush, you know, Marco Rubio he critiqued, or, you know, lying Ted Cruz he talks about. And so I think he's trying to kind of test market in a way in the political sphere a new way to frame Hillary Clinton and how he can try and take her on.
Well, Hillary Clinton was ready. She said, deal me in if you're talking about, equal rights for women, et cetera. And, she's going to go toe to toe. But is there any sense that she is vulnerable in this women don't like her thing?
I don't know exactly if she's vulnerable on the women card, but she certainly has had issues, right? I mean, Madeleine Albright famously or infamously earlier in this race got taken to the woodshed for some comments she made about you need to be with Hillary because she's a woman. She has had some vulnerabilities with younger women, younger voters in particular. And so I think that's one of the issues that her campaign is really going to have to deal with, is trying to find that enthusiasm that Bernie Sanders has really captured with the youth vote and women voters, and trying to capture that in the general election.
What has to happen in Indiana in 2 weeks for either Sanders or Cruz to bow out?
I mean, I think that if you have a Donald Trump, winning decisively in Indiana, the case for Ted Cruz to remain in the race is very weak. I don't know whether that he will actually take that as a sign that he needs to step down, and or if he'll continue that all the way through California or not. But at that point, I mean, really, there's just no mathematical ability or even, kind of calculation that they can even point to say, I have a reason to be in this race.
Doing the math for us, Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent for Politico. Anna, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Two conversations now with people who did not have much reason to cheer from yesterday's voting. Senator Ted Cruz has already moved on, looking ahead to the next big contest for Republicans in Indiana.
Now, there's been a lot of media speculation lately about vice presidential vetting, and I have an announcement to make. A major announcement. Hillary Clinton has decided on her vice presidential nominee. Hillary has picked Donald Trump.
Cruz is hoping for a big win in 2 weeks in Indiana, and that's him addressing supporters last night. And to get a piece of Indiana's 57 delegates, Cruz has been campaigning across the state all week. John Kasich, governor of neighboring Ohio, has decided not to spend money in the state, part of a pact with Cruz to work together to limit Trump delegates. But Trump is spending $1 million in TV and radio ads, and will hold a rally tonight in Indianapolis. He picked up an endorsement from legendary Indiana Hoosiers basketball coach Bobby Knight. So wither the Cruz supporters at this point in the campaign. Bruce Borders is an Indiana state representative and a Ted Cruz supporter. He's not surprised by the result, but he is disappointed. Welcome, Representative Borders.
That's good to be on your show.
What's your argument to Ted Cruz, either to stand down or the party bosses to make this quick?
I'm not sure the argument is as much to Ted Cruz as it is to Donald Trump. Once it gets to the convention, to basically say, hey, Donald, which guy are you? Are you the guy that contributes to Hillary Clinton and contributes to Planned Parenthood? I mean, what do we have to hang our hat on to believe that you're going to hold the values that you seem to come across as of late? That's the biggest problem that I have, is that if I were going to hire somebody, to wire my house, for example, I don't want somebody that read a book about wiring and decided they're an electrician. I want somebody that's already wired a lot of houses and knows what the heck they're doing. And my concern with Donald Trump is a lot of the values that he's espousing as of late, he hasn't espoused those through his entire life, whereas Ted Cruz has, quite frankly.
If Trump could convince you that he's going to toe a line that you can get behind, you're with him all the way to November.
If he ends up winning it, yeah. I mean, I will support him in November because I have a 50-50 chance that he's going to, for example, pick a Supreme Court justice, in the mold of Antonin Scalia, that he's going to hold some pro-life values. With Hillary, she's made it clear, She doesn't support any of those things. And even though I don't have the confidence in Donald Trump that I do in Ted Cruz, with Ted Cruz, I'm not worried. Those have been his values throughout his entire life. With Donald Trump, those seems to be things that he's come across as of late. With Hillary, she's made it clear. She basically doesn't hold any of the values that I hold dear.
I just want to ask you, Bruce, and I've been asking a lot of people this. What is the thing that you were saying like 6 months ago about Donald Trump? I mean, I've said plenty of things that were like totally wrong. Is there anything you could just take us back to when you were talking to friends?
I'm actually pretty pragmatic. I mean, actually, I'm a Republican, in a very heavily Democrat. Well, at least maybe at least a fairly heavily Democrat district here in Indiana. As soon as I saw the first debate, you know, last year, and people were going, "Oh, this is just a fluke." I said, "Why would it be?" I said, "You know, if you listen to what he says, and you know the values he's coming across with, I wasn't surprised to see him from the first debate on take the lead and hold it, because I just didn't think, you know, there was some type of mass hypnosis that occurred. And I guess I was never one of those that I didn't get shocked by it. I wasn't surprised at all.
Well, Bruce, I told you so. Borders, not bad. Indiana State Representative. I guess you'll have to fall back on the Elvis impersonator thing if the Cruz supporter doesn't work out.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm still serving as a state representative and still fighting hard for what I'll call conservative biblical-based values, which I think as a nation, quite frankly, we are on the verge of destroying ourselves as a nation if we don't hold to biblical values. I get sick of people talking about, well, let's just talk economy and not moral biblical values, but they go hand in hand. All truth is God's truth, not just social values, but economics and all of it. It all goes hand in hand.
Elvis tune for this moment in American politics?
Love me tender, love me sweet, never let me go. You have made my life complete, and I love you so. Love me tender, love me true, all my dreams fulfill. For my darling, I love you, and I always will.
Thank you so much. Ted Cruz supporter and Indiana State Representative Bruce Borders, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Love me tender. Love,
so if your candidate loses and you don't really have any Elvis songs to sing, who gets your vote in November?
Celestine, I'm calling from Fairfax, Virginia. Bernie Sanders is my candidate. If he does not become the Democratic Party nominee for the November election, I will angrily vote for Hillary Clinton, who I despise, do not trust, and don't hold her anything.
On Facebook, Ryan Roche writes, Bernie's candidacy pulled me reluctantly back into the Democratic Party for the primary. Now that it looks like Hillary's nomination is inevitable, I'm taking my vote back to Jill Stein and the Green Party. Later this hour, we'll take a trip to Timbuktu to learn about the brave locals who risked their lives to save 350,000 invaluable manuscripts from jihadi extremists. What matters most to you? Is there a precious item you took extra steps to protect at some point in your life? Something from a close relative?
This is a father in California. The only precious thing in my life that I took extra steps to preserve is my daughter, who reported to me that she was feeling suicidal when she was 13, and I was successful.
Charlotte, North Carolina told us, my father gave me a 100-year-old silver dollar when I went off to college. He paid for my schooling, but that dollar means the world to me. I keep it close whenever I need to channel his spirit. Comment at thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We did mostly Trump math and GOP math with Anna Palmer of Politico a moment ago, but as we reported, Hillary Clinton has now won nearly 90% of the delegates needed to secure the Democratic nomination. That means Bernie Sanders would need overwhelming wins in the next 9 nominating contests to become the nominee, but that's not an argument for him to give up yet.
We're going to fight all the way to the Philadelphia Convention, and we're going to win as many delegates as we can, and we believe we do have a path toward victory.
Bernie Sanders on ABC's Good Morning America this week. I spoke with a frankly crestfallen-sounding Sanders supporter, the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, Paul Soglin, who says the Democratic Party ignores the Sanders' big ideas at their peril.
Well, there's no question that he lit a fire a year ago in terms of addressing the questions of equality in this country when it comes to economics and justice, that it's something that's been abused for decades now by both Republicans and Democrats who've been focused on a mantra about globalization of the economy without looking at the consequences for everyday Americans.
If Hillary Clinton becomes president and looks at the program and the passionate rhetoric of Bernie Sanders and has to pick one of three things that Bernie Sanders has talked about, backing away from globalization, work on a living wage, and harder confrontation on the banks on Wall Street. What of those three do you think Hillary Clinton might be most likely to take up in her administration?
Well, the one that's closest to her center of core beliefs would be raising the minimum wage and attacking that specific problem, which has, you know, generated so many households in this country who are below the poverty level. The other two, she's got some challenges because they conflict with some of her other constituencies. While there's just a great need for dealing with financial institution reform, given her Wall Street support as a candidate and as a president, that's a little tougher for her. In terms of globalization, she's got to refute the first president, Clinton.
Would you say that's enough for the Sanders movement, for Hillary Clinton to say, all right, we're going to do living wage, the rest we'll just have to wait?
Well, as someone who's supported Senator Sanders from his beginning and his first announcements, you know, if I'm in a position of supporting Hillary Clinton, I would not be satisfied. I'd support her as a candidate, but in terms of satisfaction, no, it's got to go a lot further than the minimum wage. There has to be a fundamental restructuring of economic power in this country.
So how's that going to take place? And if we're talking about winning in November for the Democrats, at some point, Bernie Sanders is going to have to make a decision. What would you advise that decision to be, Mayor Soglin?
I'm in no position to advise Senator Sanders on something of that magnitude. From my own seat, you know, as a mayor, what I'm looking at is much more, though, than raising the minimum wage. It has to do with the availability of jobs. It's not going to do anyone good any good if there's a 15 or an 18-hour minimum wage and there's no job, that there's no retirement plan. That has to be the core of any essential change.
Except I guess what I'm asking is, where do the people of communities like yours and, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, you've stressed on a number of occasions is a diverse community politically and otherwise, but nevertheless, it is like other communities like Berkeley, California, like Tacoma Park, Maryland, for instance, that are associated with the very progressive wing of the Democratic Party, if not just the progressive wing of politics in America. Where do they go if the campaign were to end today with this sort of ending? Hillary Clinton kind of takes it all.
If the campaign ends with Hillary Clinton as the nominee and Donald Trump representing the Republican Party, there's no question that everyone votes for Hillary Clinton. But what I think is critical is that after she takes office, the examination of her policies, the criticism, is not going to end.
Do you have your hotel room in Philadelphia?
Have not yet, but we'll get around to it.
Mayor Paul Soglin is the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A decision on voting practices in North Carolina could have an impact on the fall election. A federal judge, Thomas Schroeder, upheld the state's voter ID law, which also changes a number of voting rules that affect particular groups, young people, the poor, and African Americans, among others. Michael Tomczyk is a reporter for member station WFAE in Charlotte. He says that a federal lawsuit challenging the North Carolina law will go forward, But that law is expected to apply in November, which means voters may see some surprising changes from the last time they voted for president.
There will be a week shorter early voting period, 10 days instead of 17 days. Voters will no longer be able to use same-day registration or out-of-precinct voting. And voters will need to show a photo ID, a government-issued photo ID.
So he says that this law is an impetus for everyone in the state to get their papers in order to vote, right?
Yeah, I mean, he puts it as, you know, these things that North Carolina passed back when Democrats were in control, he calls them fail-safes. Congress has never said all states have to allow same-day registration or all states have to do early voting. Some states like New York don't do any early voting. The majority of states don't offer same-day registration. So really what Judge Schroeder has decided is North Carolina offered these fail-safes under Democratic control. Republicans came into control and have their own policies. Taking away fail-safes, in his eyes, does not rise to the level of suppressing a vote. Now, of course, from the U.S. Justice Department's eyes, from the North Carolina NAACP and others who are suing over this, this is part of a broader trend where, you know, since the Supreme Court in 2013 struck down the part of the Voting Rights Act that had required states like North Carolina and Texas to get their election changes approved, since then you've had states like North Carolina and Texas pass these expansive changes to their election laws. So this very much fits into the U.S. Justice Department's new fight over voting regulations across the country.
What is the impact, the potential impact, on the general election in November in North Carolina?
The plaintiffs are saying that there will be people who are disenfranchised. They put it pretty simply. In the trial last summer, they had examples of people who, through no fault of their own, let's say the DMV screwed up their registration when they went and they registered and they showed up to vote, and they couldn't. And if you had the fail-safe of same-day registration, those people would have been able to vote. Now, the judge, in his opinion, chalks that up more to disinterest is not the same thing as disenfranchisement.
Do observers in North Carolina believe this could tip a Senate race or tip a congressional race or even shift the potential for a Republican or Democratic win in North Carolina in November?
That's been the underlying theme for all of this because, I mean, if you look at the presidential race, for example, North Carolina was so close in both of the last two. We very narrowly went for Obama in 2008 and very narrowly for Romney in 2012. A lot of the arguments have been focused on the racial side of it, John, but the political side is just as important. Where it ties together is that African Americans tend to vote Democratic. So there have been arguments about how, you know, attorneys for the state view these changes as Republican state lawmakers trying to give themselves a better shot at winning elections. Because if you do something that's going to disproportionately impact African Americans, guess what? That's also disproportionately impacting voters who tend to vote Democratic.
So this will get a look from the circuit court and then possibly the Supreme Court between now and November?
The plaintiffs have already announced that they will appeal. Whether it's this case, whether it's the Texas case, one of these will most likely get to the Supreme Court at some point.
Michael Tomczyk is a reporter for WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
A long time ago, if you were on your way to the city of Timbuktu, you might have been going there to study. You would have spoken and read Arabic back then. Besides the Holy Quran, you could learn about ethics, mathematics, philosophy, law, and astronomy from among the smartest people in the world. If the collision between Islam, Arabic, and Persian culture is seen as a battle of ideas, then in the golden age of Timbuktu in North Africa, what is now Mali in the 15th century, Islam had the upper hand. Among the most powerful ideas were contained in the libraries of Timbuktu. Those libraries with thousands of precious illuminated manuscripts still exist scattered throughout the North African desert. And for more than a decade, they've been the target of Muslim jihadists trying to remake Mali into a terror state of warped Sharia law. As the story goes, The extremists had declared jihad against anyone and everyone who challenged their vision of a pure Islamic society, and these artifacts, treatises about logic, astrology and medicine, paeans to music, poems idealizing romantic love, represented 500 years of human joy. That passage is from a new book, The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu, written by journalist Joshua Hammer. About 15 years ago, thanks to international funding and the efforts of a young man from the city of Timbuktu, Abdul Qadir Hadira, those manuscripts were brought back and preserved by teams of librarians. Joshua Hammer, the author of The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu, tells us the amazing story about the men and women who risked their lives to save some 350,000 invaluable manuscripts from destruction.
Mali in that era, in the golden era in the 15th and 16th centuries, was the center of a great North African empire. And Timbuktu was the cultural, economic, intellectual capital of that empire. So books were produced there, manuscripts, at a huge rate. And then over the centuries were scattered. The French colonial army invaded and conquered the north of Mali in the 19th century, began seizing manuscripts where they could find them, taking them to museums in Paris, libraries in Paris. So people stashed them away. And they were largely forgotten until about the 1960s when UNESCO began an effort to find them, recover them. And then that was followed by the hero of my book, Abdul Qadir Hadira, a librarian from Timbuktu, who really catalyzed this incredible effort to create libraries in Timbuktu.
What did Abdul Qadir have to go through to get these books past the extremists as time went on and as it got really, really dicey in 2012?
Well, it was an enormously complicated operation that had several stages. The first stage was taking them in the middle of the night by flashlight out of these libraries, stashing them inside private houses, where they remained for several months. Things began really heating up, I'd say 4 or 5 months into the occupation, where you started having the amputations, real serious Sharia law. The next step was to actually get them out of the safe houses in Timbuktu and smuggle them past jihadi checkpoints down to Bamako, the capital of Mali. The third and final stage came when the French military invaded, and the whole north became a war zone. You could no longer travel on the roads. At that point, he had to switch gears entirely and direct an operation down the river, which was pretty much the only safe way to move anything during that time. And even that wasn't so safe.
In this story, did people lose life and literally limb for these books?
Believe it or not, nobody did. People did come close, and certainly there were horrific acts of Sharia justice going on all around them. Public executions, a stoning to death of adulterers. You had regularly hands and feet chopped off in the public squares in Timbuktu and Gao, the main city of the north. But all the manuscripts, with the exception of 4,000 at the very end, got through intact.
And what happened to the 4,000?
Those 4,000 were left behind in a library that had been occupied early on by the jihadists and turned into a military barracks. And they had been coexisting with these volumes and doing their military training and not bothering with them, strangely enough. And then in the last days, as the French were about to seize Timbuktu, in a spasm of vengeance, they grabbed everything they could find, made a big pyre and doused it with gasoline and set them on fire, destroyed everything, reduced them to ashes. So that was a loss of 4,000, but 375,000 survived.
And among the people of Mali who understand the value of this, what does that bonfire represent?
Mali has a fairly high illiteracy rate. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. And yet there is still, even among people who can't read, a recognition of the specialness of Mali, that this very poor country was once at the center of a great intellectual and economic empire, powerful empire in North Africa. And these books are seen as vestiges of that. So this fire, even to people who couldn't read, who didn't know exactly what it represented, was taken as the last and very painful blow meted out by the jihadis in their last desperate effort.
Have you looked at these artifacts?
I have looked at many of them, yeah. When I first saw these manuscripts in 2006, I was taken into somebody's storage room. Yeah, they'd been in there for I don't know how long. I opened up these wooden chests and I picked up a volume from – must have been from the 15th century – it was bloated, waterlogged. I started turning pages. They were flutter. I was horrified. Pieces of these 600-year-old volumes fluttering away as I turned the pages. You know, I dropped it, said, I'm not going to do this. But, you know, on the other hand, there are some that are remarkably well preserved. There has been this tremendous effort over the last 10 years, this consciousness raising and money pouring in from international foundations to preserve what's left. I mean, the ones that are particularly astonishing are these illuminated manuscripts with wonderful, intricate Islamic designs and some with even representational art. I mean, human form obviously cannot be shown in Islamic art, but that hasn't prevented the artists and scribes from that period from just adorning their volumes with breathtaking art.
And what kind of books are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about a mix of Islamic and secular volumes. That was the unusual thing about Timbuktu. So we're talking about beautiful Qurans, the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet, alongside poetry, romantic poetry, science, medical volumes, history, books about sex, all sorts of subjects that the jihadists found particularly heinous and wanted to stamp out.
So Abdul Qadir and the badass librarians saved this treasure, but Mali, can it be saved?
Mali has not recovered from this, one of the most traumatic episodes in its history. The French came in 2013 and they were effective. They killed a large number of jihadis. They drove them out of the cities, but the desert is still there. There are jihadis still around. They've already conducted a few horrific terrorist operations in Bamako and elsewhere. I don't think they're capable of recapturing the north, but the instability is likely to go on for a long time.
But AK-47s and jihadis are no match for the badass librarians in this case.
Yeah, in this case. This is a rare case, but it gives a bit of hope.
Joshua Hammer is author of The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by Virtusa Polaris, a global IT services company providing IT consulting, technology, and outsourcing services. Working to help clients understand the opportunities and benefits of the Internet of Things, VirtusaPolaris.com. From Lumos City, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
When John F. Kennedy stepped into the White House in 1961, it was the culmination of a story of a family's rise in 20th century America, a story in which everybody in that family had a role to play.
The first detachment of the Clan Kennedy arrives. At Plymouth, five of the nine children of the American ambassador reach England with Mrs. Kennedy.
I'm looking forward with great anticipation to taking up my duties here.
A question addressed to the elder Miss Kennedy, aged 18, pertinent to a romance, was not regarded as impertinent, so we may hear more about that later.
Patriarch Joseph Kennedy took up at the Court of St. James in London back in 1938, appointed ambassador to Great Britain in the Franklin Roosevelt administration. Joe was a tough, opinionated voice in London and to Washington regarding tumultuous world affairs in the late 1930s. Ambassador Kennedy tried to defy both FDR and Winston Churchill to keep the U.S. out of the war with Germany.
On Sunday, I return from war-torn Europe to the peaceful shores of our beloved country, renewed in my conviction that this country must and will stay out of war.
Joe Kennedy was wrong and paid dearly for his stumbles. But all the while, Joe Kennedy's daughter, Kathleen, was nimbly negotiating British royalty and a power structure that was in decline but still deeply influential. Kathleen, called Kick, was beloved in British society and was the first entree to international power for her favorite older brother, Jack, on his way up. Then tragedy struck the family. Kick lost her oldest brother, Joe Jr., in the war. Only a month later, Kick's husband, William Cavendish, the heir apparent of the Duke of Devonshire, was also killed in the fighting. Jack was seriously injured in the Pacific, and then Kick herself died at age 28 in a plane crash. Barbara Leeming is the author of Kick Kennedy, The Charmed Life and Tragic Death of the Favorite Kennedy Daughter. She says this daughter had an impact on her time far beyond the small ways she is remembered today.
Kick Kennedy is not really the Kennedy's family story that one expects. It's very much about a young girl who desperately wants her own identity. She's very, very much like Jack. She's incredibly ambitious and wants, above all, to be a person of influence. But she's brought up in this family where Joe Kennedy tells the kids, you're Kennedys. You're not individuals. You're Kennedys. And in 1938, when old Joe Kennedy became U.S. ambassador to the court of St. James, Kick went with him. And she found her way out of the family by entering the most closed part of the British aristocracy, what I call the aristocratic cousinhood. And they took her in, were mad for her, absolutely mad for her, which is a very big question. Why? She's no beauty. She's a very sweet and very lively girl, but it isn't that. What they wanted was the toughness and the resilience and the competitiveness, and they recognized it. And she became the red blood for their blue blood.
Well, what's so astounding here is that, you know, Joe Kennedy has real problems figuring out and decoding the British world that he thinks he's got down pat and learns that he doesn't. But Kick innately understands the sort of power language of this cousinhood. Why do you think she does?
I think that, first of all, she had an incredible set of guides when she arrived there. Once they found her, they took great care to make sure she saw something that was, I think, the absolute antithesis of what her father was saying, and that is a world in which duty and honor were enormously, enormously appealing. And she believed it. What happened, I mean, it's a very simple thing. She fell in love very quickly at the age of 18 with a boy who was Billy Hardington, who was the heir to the Duke of Devonshire. And she believed that by becoming a duchess, she would have the kind of power and influence that her brother was going for in the presidency. What she didn't understand was that she had walked in at a pivotal moment in British history, which was the moment when the political power of the aristocracy was vanishing forever, which it did in the Second World War. Billy Hardington was killed 4 months after Kick married him and never became the Duke, obviously. She never became the Duchess. Andrew Devonshire and his wife, Debo Devonshire, were just the most wonderful guides to me to this world. And both of them said, you know, that politics for them was in the blood. And having them as guides to explain it to you was really quite an incredible experience.
If Kick had survived, what do you think her role in the administration might have been?
I think that what had happened, Jack had been assimilated into Kick's British family. They referred to him as their American cousin. And I think that what you would have had, Kick would have played a bigger role than Debo Devonshire played. When Kick died, Debo Devonshire became the Duchess, and she and Jack became very close. And she would come to the White House and visit and whatever. And Macmillan would use her to say, you know, to bring a message to Jack, but more than that, to make the tie closer, to keep him bound to the Brits. And he was. And I think, obviously, if it had been his own sister, it would have been even stronger. And I think for Kick, she would have been wild in that. Would have made a complicated sort of secondary first lady, I guess. But, I mean, she would have loved it.
Talk about the funeral. The hits that Joe takes in his life are extraordinary, and this was one of them.
You know, as awful as Joe Kennedy can be, he's also about as sad a character as you can possibly have. Of course, he lost his favorite son, Joe, in the last part of the war. He lost his son-in-law when Kick's husband was killed. The injuries that Jack suffered in becoming a war hero in the Pacific were devastating. He saw his family torn apart by that war, and then his favorite daughter is killed in a plane crash, coming to him in Paris, trying to get him to okay her marriage to a married Protestant, a man called Peter Wentworth Fitzwilliam, the 8th Earl Fitzwilliam. When she was killed in the plane crash with Fitzwilliam, Joe, there was nothing he could do. And the body just lay in Paris unclaimed. Nobody was doing anything. Rose was completely freaked out, did nothing. Jack started to come to England and turned around in New York and headed for Hyannis. and the body is there. And who is going to bury her? Nobody's doing anything. And Kick's mother-in-law, who is a character called Mauser Devonshire, she was the Duchess of Devonshire, she adored Kick. And Mauser said to Joe, look, would you allow us to bury Kick here with Billy's family? She's Billy's wife, even though she was going to marry somebody else. We love her. We want to take care of her. Joe said, yeah, bury her. Yes, you can. And so Joe went with the body to England. And I remember Debo saying to me that when he arrived at the gravesite, she's buried just above Chatsworth up in a little graveyard on a hill. When Joe was standing next to the grave, Debo said he had this terrible navy blue suit on, which I guess he'd been wearing for days. And she said it was just all crumbled up. And she said, I kept looking at the suit and I realized he was more crumbled than the suit was. It was, I mean, everything had been taken out of him at that point. And it was, I mean, she said it was just a picture of everything that had been lost.
Barbara Leeming, author of Kick Kennedy, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John. It's wonderful talking to you.
Here's a historical fact. Jack Kennedy eventually did visit that grave just months before his death. He made an unpublicized secret trip to Kick Kennedy's grave on his way home for an emotional trip to Ireland, the first for a U.S. president. He brought flowers with him from the Emerald Isle to his sister's grave, and he brought another sister, Jean, who would go on to serve as ambassador to Ireland under President Clinton. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.